Hello and welcome to our programme. My name is Angus McVicar and I will be reading Time magazine here on Sight into Sound Radio. We start this week with some words from our editor. Fighting an injustice. There are two moments in Charlotte Alter's cover story on the unjust imprisonment of American journalist Evan Gershkovich that I can't get out of my head. The first is a phone call between Wall Street Journal editor Emma Tucker and Paul Beckett, then the journal's Washington bureau chief, at the time of Gershkovich's detention. The shock running through that moment, which Charlotte includes in a retelling of the hours that followed Gershkovich's arrest, speaks volumes about the unreality of his abduction into the Russian judicial system. Even after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, Gershkovich had continued to report from Russia regularly. He told his parents not to worry. After all, he was a journalist, accredited by the Foreign Ministry. Gershkovich thought that status would protect him, even as a new life there had changed. Reporting in Russia is now also a regular practice of watching people you know get locked away for years, he wrote on Twitter, now X, in July 2022. On March 29, 2023, Gershkovich joined that number, which includes fellow American Paul Whelan, a former Marine serving a 16-year prison sentence on false charges of spying. The recent death of activist Alexei Navalny in a Russian penal colony only underscored the precarity of their situation and negated the possibility of a prisoner exchange that could have included all three, Charlotte reports. The second moment in the story that I can't forget comes at the end. This one made me hopeful. Anyone who reads Charlotte's story will see clearly that Gershkovich appears to have lost neither his sense of self nor his sense of humour. Even behind the walls of Levertovo prison, he has found ways to share his love for others. Gershkovich saw reporting in Russia as a calling, one made all the more important because the freedom of Russian journalists had been almost entirely curtailed. That silencing is only one example of the pressures the press has faced in the past decade. 6 years ago, we recognized the courage and threat that journalists like Maria Ressa of the Philippines, Rappler, faced by selecting as Person of the Year a collection of reporters and editors under fire, a group we called the Guardians. Their courage has not relented, but neither have the threats. According to a December 2023 report from the Committee to Protect Journalists, Gershkovich was one of 320 journalists around the world who are imprisoned for their work. That is the second highest number since the organization began counting in 1992. At Time magazine, we hope our journalism leads to action. We set out to tell the story of Gershkovich's arrest and imprisonment and its impact on his family, friends and co-workers in the hours and months to follow. We know that hundreds of people are fighting today to free Gershkovich. In October, he turned 32 in his jail cell. And on March 29th, it will have been a full year since his arrest on false charges of espionage. We join the journalists and their supporters at the Wall Street Journal, as well as our colleagues across our industry, in calling for his release. We look forward to the day when Gershkovich is free, back with his friends and family, back doing the work he loves. End of article. The fight to free Evan. On March 29, 2023, Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich was arrested in Russia on bogus espionage charges. He remains imprisoned in Moscow, a political hostage in his parents' homeland. Inside the struggle to bring him home, written by Charlotte Alter. Growing up in the Soviet Union in the 1960s and 70s, Mikhail Gershkovich and Ella Milman learned to be careful. Children knew not to repeat what their parents said in their kitchens. Mikhail recalls his father, who grew up under Stalin, offering a piece of advice. If you're going to tell a political joke, make sure there are no witnesses. Mikhail and Ella both emigrated to the US in 1979, seeking to escape rising anti-Semitism and life under Soviet rule. They met in Brooklyn in the 1980s, got married and raised an American family in suburban New Jersey. Their daughter Danielle took swimming and gymnastics. Their son Evan played soccer. "Here we can relax," says Mikhail. "Just find yourself. Decide what you want to do." Evan Gershkovich decided he wanted to be a journalist, a calling that took him back to his parents' homeland. He had grown up speaking Russian and wanted to use his familiarity with the language and culture to pursue his career. He worked as a reporter for the Moscow Times, adjuncts France Press and the Wall Street Journal. When Ella worried about him writing articles critical of the Russian government or economy, her son explained that he was an accredited journalist, his mother recalls, repeating the phrase as though it were a magic shield. But it wasn't. On March 29, 2023, Evan Gershkovich was detained by Russian security forces while meeting a source at a restaurant in Yekaterinburg, an industrial city about 1,000 miles east of Moscow. He has been a political prisoner in Moscow's Lefortovo prison for nearly a year, the first American journalist to be accused of espionage in Russia since the Cold War. Gershkovich is not a spy. He has never worked for the US government. The White House calls the charges against him ridiculous and classifies Gershkovich as wrongfully detained. Russia has taken Americans hostage before, but an accredited journalist is another level in terms of what it says about the country's relationship with the West, or America specifically, says Gershkovich's friend Polina Ivanova, who covers Russia for the Financial Times. His arrest was a watershed moment that represents Russia's disregard for international norms, Ivanova adds. It wasn't that Evan's work had changed, it was that Russia changed. For his immigrant family, Gershkovich's detention shattered a belief that their son could chase his American dream in the country of his heritage. Perhaps the cruelest irony is that Gershkovich loved the Russian culture. His goal as a reporter, family and friends say, was to depict in its full complexity a country that is often reduced to caricature. Instead, Gershkovich is trapped in limbo. So are his parents. 40 years after they fled Soviet Russia, their only son has become a political pawn in a new Cold War, a human bargaining chip for Vladimir Putin as relations between the two countries cratered with the invasion of Ukraine. On February 20th, Russian courts rejected the latest appeal filed by Gershkovich's lawyers. He is set to remain in prison through at least March 30th, a year since he was originally detained. While the Biden administration calls his release a top priority, negotiations to free him have not made progress. Late last year, the U.S. presented a significant proposal to free Gershkovich and former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan, who has been held by Russia since 2018 and is currently serving a 16-year sentence in a penal colony on spurious charges of espionage, according to State Department spokesman Matt Miller. The Russians turned it down. Putin has expressed openness to a potential prisoner swap. The US and Russia completed one in December 2022, exchanging the American basketball star Brittany Reiner, who was detained in Russia for drug possession, for the notorious arms dealer Viktor Bout. But there are significant obstacles to consummating a deal now, according to two US officials familiar with the talks. Those officials say the US isn't holding any prisoners Russia values highly enough to exchange for Gershkovich and Whelan. Putin has sought the release of the convicted Russian hitman Vadim Krasikov, who is serving a life sentence in Germany for assassinating a Georgian dissident of Chechen ethnicity in a Berlin park in 2019. But US officials say Germany is not currently willing to include Krasikov in a swap. The suspicious death of Russian dissident Alexei Navalny in a Siberian penal colony presents an additional complication. Allies of Navalny alleged on February 26 that he was killed before he could be released in a deal that would have involved Gershkovich and Krasikov. A US official familiar with the negotiations tells Time magazine that no formal proposal for a three-way prisoner swap had been extended involving Navalny and US citizens, but that in nascent conversations, Germany seemed more willing to release Krasikov while Navalny was alive. Now that Navalny is dead, Germany is very much cooled to the idea, the official says. The political context also contributes to the challenge. Putin may be reluctant to make a deal before the US election in November because he prefers that President Joe Biden lose to Donald Trump and is wary of making an exchange that might be seen as a victory for Biden, people familiar with the talks believe. They're not looking to hand the administration any wins, says a US official. The administration says that Gershkovich's release is the top priority. Not a day goes by without intensive efforts from the State Department and others across the US government to reunite Evan and Paul with their families. Roger Carstens, their special presidential envoy for hostage affairs, said in a statement to Time magazine. Gershkovich's family and friends have not given up hope. Pessimism is a quality common in Russia, Milman says as she sits in Danielle's Philadelphia apartment. The walls are decorated with illustrations Evan gifted Danielle over the years. A cat wearing a tie, a devil playing a cello, a joke sign from a cemetery that says, "Sorry, we're dead." It's the optimism that carries me on, Milman says. If you accept the negative, it's like the game is over. Gershkovich arrived in Russia in 2017. 3 years out of college, he had landed a job at the Moscow Times, an independent online newspaper that publishes in both English and Russian. He formed a close-knit group of journalist friends who lived in the same Moscow neighborhood, Christy Prudy. They hung out at hipster cafes, art exhibitions and concerts. They joined Russian soccer teams. They rented a dacha outside the city where they spent summers grilling and winters cross-country skiing. The job was endlessly interesting. Russia was a place where journalists had freedom to maneuver and freedom to do lots of good work, says Ivanova. It was this exciting place to discover that he had lots of connections to and cultural knowledge about. When Gershkovich's parents arrived for a visit in 2018, Milman was struck by the country's transformation. The family walked through the Hermitage in St. Petersburg and sampled Evan's cafe recommendations in a new shiny Moscow, as Milman describes it. Evan was excited to show them the Moscow he had come to love, says his close friend Pyotr Sawyer. Putin's Russia has always been a dangerous place for reporters. At least 39 journalists and media workers have been murdered in Russia since 1992, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. But Gershkovich was an American citizen with formal press accreditation from the Russian government. He felt his own safety risks were minimal. Every year it was becoming more authoritarian, says Sawyer. But you still felt like you could talk to opposition leaders. There were protests. You could travel. After Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, those freedoms were curtailed. There were new laws that inhibited journalists' movements and new rules about what could and couldn't be said. Many journalists left. The ones who didn't were constantly looking over their shoulders. Gershkovich himself moved to London, but he returned to report as often as he could. Reporting in Russia is now also a regular practice of watching people you know get locked away for years, Gershkovich tweeted in July 2022. He told friends he had occasionally been followed. If anything, the exodus of colleagues made him more committed to his work. He saw it as his mission to be back in Moscow, said Sawyer. He felt like he had a responsibility to tell this story. Gershkovich was not in the habit of keeping his parents apprised of his whereabouts at all times. When he called on March 27th, 2023, his mother had thought he was in London. "He called me to reassure me that everything was okay," Milman recalls. He said, "I'm delaying going back. I want to finish something." Milman was vaguely unsettled, but she trusted him. 2 days later, on the morning of March 29th, Gerskovich exchanged texts with Sawyer about Arsenal, their favourite soccer team. They made plans to meet up in Berlin for Easter. There was no hint of alarm. We couldn't imagine that he would be taken off the street and charged with espionage, says Sawyer. It had never happened in modern Russia. It seemed out of the range of possibility. That afternoon, Gerskovich was detained by Russia's Federal Security Services, FSB, at a steakhouse in Yekaterinburg. He was escorted out of the restaurant with his hood pulled over his head. Emma Tucker, the editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal, woke to her phone ringing shortly before 4 a.m. and knew the news was bad. Liz Harris, the journal's managing editor, was calling. There were unconfirmed reports online that the FSB had detained Gerskovich on suspicion of espionage, Harris told Tucker. Tucker had braced for this. The previous day, Harris had notified her that Gerskovich had missed his check-in on the Dow Jones Global Security System, a standard procedure in dangerous reporting assignments. At first, Tucker took the news in stride. His phone could have died. There was no need to panic. But later that afternoon, Harris said that Gerskovich had missed a second check-in. Editors were worried. After the second missed check-in, Tucker called Paul Beckett, then the journal's Washington bureau chief. Beckett was at a dinner in D.C. The appetizers had just been served. He walked out into the courtyard to take the call from his new boss, Paul, Tucker said in a clipped British accent. Evan Gerskovich has gone missing. At that point, missing simply meant that editors hadn't heard from him. But Beckett began reaching out to national security contacts. By a little before 8 p.m. he had contacted a top aide to Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, called the State Department's press office and emailed Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer. Finer called back within the hour, assuring Beckett that the administration was taking the situation seriously. Around 10:30 that night, Secretary of State Antony Blinken called Beckett and Tucker. The editors held out hope. I kept waiting for the call saying, okay, he was roughed up by the security services, but he's out, says Tucker. And that call just didn't come. Instead came an FSB press release announcing that Gerskovich had been arrested on espionage charges. It was a body blow, says Almer Latour, CEO of Dow Jones, which publishes the journal. It confirmed our worst fears. With the spurious allegations of espionage, the stakes went up, Latour adds, and the level of complexity immediately became much greater. Tucker had been the top editor of the paper for only a few weeks. She had just moved from London to take the job, and most of her furniture had not yet been delivered. She sat in a stool at her kitchen counter and got on a call with a few senior editors. Together they drafted a note to the newsroom, relaying what they knew. Beckett spent the next 36 hours wrangling government support. It was important to us that the message comes from the White House as quickly as possible that he is not a spy, Beckett says. Tucker embarked on a media tour. Someone along the way gave us the advice that there are moments to be loud and moments to be quiet, and this is a moment to be loud, Beckett says. That became a bit of a mantra. The legal team at Dow Jones focused on getting Gerskovich the right representation, a challenge complicated by the withdrawal of most Western law firms from Russia. One hurdle was finding a good lawyer who wasn't politically aligned in one way or another, recalls Jay Conte, Dow Jones' general counsel. You don't want that to be a signal. When Harris called Gerskovich's family to tell them Evan had gone missing, his mother was the one who answered the phone. I've never experienced anything like it, Millman says. It's a shock. Harris promised to call Millman every hour, whether there was news or not, and to update her as soon as she heard anything. Time stops, Michal recalls. It's hard to breathe. Tucker and Harris went to Philadelphia to meet the Gerskovich family for lunch at a tapas restaurant. The meeting made the family feel that we were not alone, Millman says. We were supported. In recent months, the family has been in almost daily contact with the journal. They hear from Carstens, the special envoy for hostage affairs, roughly every week. Whether or not there are major updates in the case, usually there aren't. Milman has seen her son twice since his arrest. It's the cages that stick out in her mind. In late May 2023, when his parents visited him in Lefortovo, Evan was in a metal cage. The second time that June, they came to one of his pre-trial appearances in a Moscow courtroom. This time the cage was glass. We walked in and noticed a huge smile, Milman recalls. We went and stood next to him and immediately Evan was already talking and joking. The family had a brief conversation through the glass. We were laughing, Milman says. Russians don't expect laughter in a court. Crying, that's what they expect. But we were laughing. Gershkovich writes his family upbeat letters about once a week. Over correspondence, he plays long-distance chess with his father and trades jokes with his mother. Danielle sends him gossip about family members and celebrities and does tarot card readings for him. Gershkovich spends time answering the mail he receives, which is translated into Russian and passes through prison censors. He reads Russian literature. Someone sent him a book of exercises you can perform in a small space using your own body weight. He tries to maintain his mental health. His primary focus, as his family, seems to be reassuring them from afar. U.S. Ambassador to Russia Lynn Tracy, who has visited Gershkovich 8 times since his detainment, says she's been impressed by his amazing resilience of spirit. Even behind bars, Tracy says, Gershkovich has been keeping up with U.S. current events. Whatever topic I'm bringing, she adds, I always have to have a little more information for the follow-up question that I know I'm going to get. Lefortovo is notorious for conditions that can border on psychological torture. Most prisoners are kept in isolation so complete that guards make a special clicking sound as they escort prisoners through the hallways to warn prisoners from interacting and passing. Physically, it's fine. You know that you cannot be attacked by anyone. It's about psychology, says Andrei Soldatov, a Russian journalist who has been questioned at Lefortovo. The interrogations are excruciating, long, slow conversations in which the questioners constantly reformulate answers in bureaucratic language in order to trick prisoners into incriminating themselves. For Gershkovich's family, friends and colleagues, the ordeal has been a lesson in the agonizing dynamics of international hostage negotiations. The journal has launched a task force and a media campaign called Hashtag I Stand With Evan. The arrest was a signal from Russia. Welcome to the world of dictators where the rules are different, Latour says. We have to make sure that this behavior is seen as unacceptable on the global stage. Russian secrecy laws governing espionage charges make it difficult for either the attorneys or diplomats to get clear updates on the legal substance of his case, and there has been little apparent progress on the diplomatic front. What we're seeing is the Russian government treating innocent people as political pawns, Ambassador Tracy says. While she won't comment on the status of ongoing negotiations, she notes that the Russians are transactional in their approach. This is hostage-taking to trade for something. The extension of Gershkovich's pre-trial detention through the end of March creates an added complication. Until the trial, it wouldn't be clear exactly what alleged evidence Russia is planning to bring against him. U.S. officials familiar with the situation say they're bracing for the possibility that Gershkovich may face a fate similar to Whelan's, a secretive sham trial followed by a sentencing to a penal colony. In the rare interview in early February, Putin suggested to Tucker Carlson that he was open to releasing Gershkovich in a prisoner swap and said that Russia is in ongoing dialogue with the US. I do not rule out that the person you are referring to, Mr. Gershkovich, may return to his motherland, Putin said. But Putin also appeared to allude to Krasikov, the Russian hitman imprisoned in Germany. Krasikov is not currently available to us, says a US official familiar with the negotiations, who notes, in addition to the death of Navalny, the heinous nature of Krasikov's crime. The US is negotiating with allied countries in an attempt to cobble together other offers, adds the official. Biden administration officials fear Putin may slow walk negotiations during a presidential election year. It wasn't a coincidence, one says, that Griner was released only after the 2022 midterms. They're trying to maximize pain and political pressure, the official says. In the meantime, Gershkovich sits in Lefortovo, writing to his family and friends, carrying on his active social life in prison. He keeps track of his friends' birthdays and writes others with specific instructions for giving them gifts, which flowers to buy and how to deliver them. When Ivanova had a birthday in late January, another friend urgently requested to meet up with her, then handed her a bouquet of tulips. The note said, "From your friend, who couldn't write the card himself." End of article. We have come to the halfway point of our program. You're listening to Time Magazine on Sight into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight into Sound channel on HD4 or 88.7 KUHF. Channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as Amazon Alexa and Google Home devices. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. The Brief, It's Trump's Party, written by Eric Cortalesa. The MAGA movement's takeover of the GOP is now complete. Every 4 years, Super Tuesday makes for high drama, as voters in roughly a dozen states winnow down the presidential field. This time it only confirmed what had seemed obvious for months. The Republican primary was over. With a series of smashing victories, Donald Trump had effectively clinched the nomination. His last remaining opponent, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, suspended her campaign the next morning. While she didn't endorse Trump, most of the party was already falling in line behind him. "They call it Super Tuesday for a reason," Trump told supporters in a victory speech at Mar-a-Lago. "This is the big one." Trump's triumph gets him another step closer to reclaiming the presidency and pursuing a draconian policy agenda unlike any the nation has ever seen. He has vowed to round up and deport millions of undocumented immigrants, reimpose his travel ban in Muslim-majority countries, purge the federal bureaucracy of civil servants and replace them with MAGA loyalists, force homeless Americans off the streets and into tent cities, and commandeer the Justice Department to exact revenge on his political enemies. He also grows closer to squashing two of the former criminal prosecutions against him. As president, he could shut down his federal indictments, one for election interference and another for mishandling the nation's secrets. When Trump left office in January 2021, after unleashing a mob in the U.S. Capitol, few foresaw him engineering a one-sided victory 3 years later in one of the least competitive open primaries in U.S. history. But Trump and his allies did. They had a plan from the start to kneecap heretics and scare off political challengers. Their success was never inevitable. When Trump launched his candidacy in November 2022, he was under a dark cloud. Republicans had just suffered a disappointing midterm cycle, with many of his handpicked candidates losing critical races. The party's own top brass saw it as a sign to move on from the former president. Not a single member of Congress attended the Trump campaign kickoff at Mar-a-Lago. Trump's foremost priority was to neuter the man many presumed to be his most formidable intra-party threat, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who had just won a landslide re-election. Trump quickly went to work, debasing him with nicknames such as Meatball Ron and Tiny D, dispatching a brigade of online trolls to mock his campaign missteps, and racking up endorsements from Florida's congressional delegation. The attacks not only undermined DeSantis's attempt to pitch himself as a more competent version of Trump, they also sent a message to would-be rivals: be prepared to face the career-destroying wrath of a MAGA onslaught. His campaign was actually revived by the indictments, which Trump framed as an attack of his supporters. The maneuver enabled him to rise in the polls and raise millions with each new charge. At the same time, he cunningly used his ordeal to box in his GOP adversaries with a catch-22. If they claimed he couldn't win the White House because of his legal woes, he characterized them as part of a conspiracy to derail his candidacy. Yet if they defended him, as most did, they only amplified and corroborated his central argument with Republican voters. From then on, Trump barely had to make an effort. He faced a weak field of rivals who were too timid to attack his greatest vulnerabilities. When Trump skipped every primary debate, he made the events seem like little more than additions to be his running mate. By the time Haley took the gloves off, she'd already lost in Iowa and New Hampshire, and seemed to be mounting more of a symbolic anti-Trump mission than a serious presidential bid. But as she hung on, Trump and his allies branded her a warmongering neocon, even though her primary foreign policy experience was as Trump's envoy to the United Nations, and set out to humiliate her. In her home state of South Carolina, Trump won by 20 points. After Haley secured her first primary win in Washington, D.C., the Trump campaign called her the Queen of the Swamp. Even before Haley formally dropped out, Trump had already signaled a turn to the general election. He proposed a revamp of the Republican National Committee, installing new loyalists to lead the organization, and narrowed his attacks on President Joe Biden. The only remaining question was whether Haley would try to unite her supporters around Trump. Sources say she doesn't plan to endorse her former boss. None of that seemed to be on Trump's mind at the end of Super Tuesday, or at least he wasn't showing it. He never mentioned Haley's name in his victory speech. Instead, he focused on the last man standing in the way of his return to power. "We've watched our country take a great beating over the last 3 years," Trump said. "We're going to take back our country." End of article. The Bulletin. Spring won't bring Gaza relief. The war in Gaza is entering its 6th month and its 3rd season. More than 30,000 people have been killed there since the Israeli offensive answering Hamas's October 7th massacre, and some 1.9 million displaced people have endured homelessness in punishing winter weather, marked by heavy rain and low temperatures. And while many may greet the arrival of spring as a reprieve from the cold, experts warn that the higher temperatures come with their own set of challenges, ones that stand to make the situation in Gaza even worse. Disease threat, higher temperatures, besides bringing relief from the cold, can accelerate the spread of communicable diseases, such as diarrhea and hepatitis A. It's the perfect environment for a massive epidemic to take hold, warns Francesco Cicci, an epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who specializes in disease control in crisis. Among Cicci's top concerns is that warmer weather could lead to a cholera outbreak, noting that Gaza's decimated healthcare system doesn't have the resources to cope with illnesses that require extensive rehydration. Perhaps the most acute crisis is the dire shortfall of food and other humanitarian aid entering the Strip, conditions the UN and others have warned will make famine almost inevitable. Fozia Alvey, a Canadian physician who recently returned from a medical trip to Gaza, tells Time magazine she witnessed children who had symptoms of severe malnutrition, including some who she believes were suffering from rickets, a condition that often stems from dietary deficiencies. She also saw fungal infections and hepatitis A, the spread of which she attributed to widespread overcrowding. "The children and the adults who escaped the bombing and sniper shots, they will die from the diseases." "The situation continues to deteriorate day by day," the International Rescue Committee has said, noting that only a swift and lasting ceasefire would allow the level of aid that the people of Gaza so urgently need to survive. In a recent study, Cicci and his co-authors projected that even in the absence of epidemics, an additional 58,260 Palestinians will be killed over the next 6 months if things remain unchanged. That figure jumps to 74,290 in the event of an escalation. The way things are heading right now is consistent with our worst-case scenario, Chi-Chi says. Perhaps even a little bit worse than that. r/WallStreetBets, one of the platform's biggest communities, banded together to push GameStop's stock price upward in unprecedented ways. Now Reddit itself is hoping to tap into its users' unruly energy by allowing them to participate in the company's IPO. Reddit filed to go public on February 22nd, seeking a valuation of at least $5 billion. Crucially, the company said it would set aside a large number of shares for 75,000 of the company's most prolific users, who might be able to profit off the company's financial success. But rather than galvanizing the community, the news was met with fierce backlash and pessimism from many Redditors, who cast doubt in the company's business model, complained about recent changes to the site, and ironically threatened to wield their collective power to bet against the company's stock. The overwhelming negativity from Reddit's own community illuminates a fundamental problem with social media, where business models are often at odds with the people platforms ostensibly serve. Reddit is one of the most visited websites in the US, with 73 million daily active users. But the company is still unprofitable. While it grew 21% in revenue last year, it also lost more than $90 million. Compared with Instagram, X, and other social media platforms, Reddit has especially struggled to monetize its audience through ads, partly because its content is generally more freewheeling and untamed than that of its counterparts. Reddit is powered by users who post content and moderate the site mostly for free. And while Redditors tend to be intensely devoted to their subreddits, the subject-specific forums that make up the platform, many have grown increasingly disillusioned with the platform overall. Last summer, hundreds of Reddit communities engaged in a widespread blackout to protest price changes for third-party app developers. When Reddit goes public, likely in the next couple of months, it will be the first major tech IPO of 2024 and the first social media IPO since Pinterest's in 2019. Very few companies have taken this route recently because of a turbulent stock market and high interest rates. As Reddit woos traditional high-profile investors, it also established a directed shares program, which lets the most active Redditors buy into the IPO early. But the announcement did not have the intended effect. Redditors responded with disdain, accusing the company of prioritizing profits at their expense. "They're trying to trick us into buying their stock to pump up the price," wrote one user. Another compared the program to a company throwing a pizza party for its workers, then forcing them to buy the pizza. A spokesperson for Reddit did not respond to a request for comment. r/WallStreetBets looms large over the IPO. If those users get involved, they hold the collective power to move the company's stock price in unpredictable ways. Reddit even acknowledged this in its filing, writing that the participation of Redditors could result in increased volatility. So far, r/WallStreetBets has not taken kindly to the idea. Many of them actually threatened to short Reddit's stock, to bet on its failure. In particular, they complained about the vast difference between the compensation of Reddit CEO Steve Huffman, who received more than $193 million in 2023, including stock and option awards, and that of volunteer moderators, who do the heavy lifting of organizing and overseeing the site's communities while making nothing. However, some super users retained faith in the company. One who said his name was Kevin, but asked to remain anonymous over concerns about his job and personal life, wrote to Time magazine that he planned to buy shares in the IPO, believing that the current negative sentiment was more of a product of Reddit's tendency to devolve into hive mind as opposed to wielding expertise or insight. "Every year there are comments that the site or company are going downhill from what it used to be," he wrote, "yet it continues to grow at a rapid pace." End of article. Next, we turn to our milestone section of the magazine. Burned. Texas's scorched panhandle. 1 million acres swept by fire. The Smokehouse Creek Fire was named for the place it began on February 26th. The grasslands lining a tributary to the Canadian River north of Amarillo, Texas. But within days, dry winds had blown it into the second largest wildfire in U.S. history, a galloping, aptly named conflagration that by March 6th had burned 1.1 million acres and caused the deaths of two people, an 83-year-old woman found in her burned home and a 44-year-old woman who died after being found outside her truck that had been overtaken by smoke and flames. Three other wildfires, the Windy Deuce, the Magenta, and the Grapevine Creek, also raged into the first week of March, taking in a few days nearly a half as many acres as wildfires had burned across the entire nation in all of 2023. As of March 7th, only the Magenta had been contained. In neighboring Oklahoma, multiple fires burned more than 300,000 acres. Evacuations were ordered across the region, and at least 500 structures were destroyed. But in cattle country, most of the losses were animals. Thousands of head lost, among the millions that grazed grasslands that had grown especially tall over the past year. Republican Governor Greg Abbott issued a state disaster declaration in 60 Texas counties. On the other end of the state, President Biden paid tribute to first responders during a visit to the border at Brownsville. "When disasters strike, there is no red state or blue state where I come from," he said. "There are just communities and families looking for help." He noted that Texas had received $13 billion in relief funding under his presidency, and that the frequency of disasters flowing from extreme weather has ticked up sharply. "I love some of my Neanderthal friends who still think there's no climate change." Approved. A first for abortion. A constitutional right for France. France became the world's first country to explicitly enshrine abortion rights into its constitution amid a rollback in reproductive rights in the US and elsewhere. Following a final vote on March 4th, the bill was approved by members of parliament, summoned to Paris by President Emmanuel Macron for a special meeting. The historic bill needed at least three-fifths of the vote to pass. Macron's government proposed the wording: "The law determines the conditions by which it is exercised the freedom of women to have recourse to an abortion, which is guaranteed." The bill has been well received across the political spectrum, with no major parties in Parliament opposed. The move marks the 25th Amendment made to the Fifth Republic's founding document. "We're sending a message to all women. Your body belongs to you, and no one can decide for you," said Prime Minister Gabriel Attal. Died. Designer, businesswoman and style icon Iris Apfel on March 1st, aged 102. Died. Comedian Richard Lewis of Curb Your Enthusiasm fame on February 27th, aged 76. Bested. The NCAA Division I all-time scoring record by Iowa's Caitlin Clark, when her career total hit 3,685 points in a March 3rd game against Ohio State, breaking Pete Maravich's 1970 record. Fined. Liberty University for $14 million, the largest fine ever levied under the Federal Clery Act on March 5th for the evangelical school's treatment of sexual assault survivors and underreporting crime. Admitted. Sweden into NATO on March 7th, 2 years after applying for membership in the wake of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It is the 32nd country to join the transatlantic military alliance. Pleaded guilty. Jack Teixeira, intelligence leaker. The Massachusetts Air National Guardsman at the center of one of the most significant leaks of national security documents in a decade pleaded guilty to posting dozens of highly classified intelligence records in an online chat group. Jack Teixeira, 22 years old, accepted a prison sentence of up to 16 years as part of his guilty plea deal. Announced March 4th, the Justice Department will not pursue any further charges against him under the Espionage Act. According to his plea agreement, Teixeira will have to participate in a debrief with officials at the Pentagon, the Justice Department and intelligence agencies. He will also have to hand over any documents or other materials still in his possession. Compared with similar cases related to the mishandling of classified information, this will be one of the longest sentences ever imposed, says Stephanie Siegman, the former chief of the National Security Unit of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston. End of article. In health news, our next article is titled Zyn Triggers Fears of a New Teen Nicotine Craze, written by Jamie Ducharme. Not so long ago, Juul was seen as the new Marlboro. Smoking wasn't that cool anymore. Rates had plummeted among U.S. adults and teens. But then came a sleek, addictive product with flashy advertising tactics that took off like wildfire. It soon became clear that e-cigarettes were hooking teens who otherwise wouldn't have gone near nicotine. Now Juul is out, and Zyn is in. It's even more discreet than Juul, with no plumes of vapour. All a user has to do is tuck a small pouch of nicotine, additives and flavourings under their lip for up to an hour. Over that time, the pouch releases a steady hit of nicotine, more than that in a cigarette, but delivered much more slowly. Like Juul, it contains no tobacco. You're not alone if you're just hearing of Zyn, but it's been for sale in the US since 2014. Like other products that launched around that time, including Juul, it hit the market when the US Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, had few regulations for new tobacco and nicotine products. The agency retroactively required these brands and others to prove they benefit public health enough to stay in the market. And Zyn's manufacturer has filed the necessary applications, but the FDA hasn't reached a decision yet. Without regulatory oversight, Zyn has become the latest product to lure people to a new and at least seemingly less dangerous way to consume nicotine. It's a parallel world with what happened with e-cigarettes, says Matches Gunowitz, a nicotine and tobacco control researcher at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center in New York. Still, Zyn is nowhere close to as ubiquitous as Juul once was, according to the most recent available data. About 4.5% of US adults vaped and 11.5% smoked in 2021, but only about 2% used smokeless tobacco products. And just 1.5% of US teenagers said they currently use nicotine pouches in 2023. For context, at the height of Juul's popularity in 2019, 27% of US high schoolers said they had vaped in the past month. It's not an apples-to-apples comparison, says Corey Henry, director of US communications at Zyn's parent company Philip Morris International, PMI. To be honest, it's not even an apples to asteroids comparison. But oral nicotine products have picked up significant traction in recent years. The Federal Trade Commission recently reported that the category's U.S. sales more than doubled from $453 million in 2020 to roughly $1 billion in 2022. And Zyn's U.S. business grew by 62% from 2022 to 2023 alone, according to an earnings report from PMI. Zyn also started to go viral, which raises concerns about the product appealing to teens who might otherwise stay away from nicotine, says Dr. Robert Jackler, a tobacco advertising expert and professor emeritus at Stanford University. The market for these pouches is rapidly growing, and it's being driven by many attributes that would be attractive to young people in the way e-cigarettes such as Juul were, Jackler says, including appealing flavours such as mint, citrus and coffee, and advertising that makes users look attractive, active and cool. We've seen this playbook before, Jackler says. There's even a name for people who post about the pouches, Zinfluencers, prompting concern from some public health officials and lawmakers. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer recently called for a crackdown on products like Zyn, warning parents that companies lock their sights on young kids, teenagers and even lower, and then use the social media to hook them. Zyn does not hire influencers or use models younger than 35 in its ads, Henry says. It also bars anyone younger than 21 from accessing its website and flags social media posts that depict underage or dangerous use of Zyn to the platforms. But the company can't police the internet, Henry says. Platforms including TikTok already prohibit posts that show or encourage underage drug, alcohol or tobacco use. Yet, Henry says these policies don't always catch everything. Henry says PMI does everything required and more to prevent underage Zyn use. Its ads, he says, are meant to appeal to adult tobacco users looking to switch, not teenagers. The average Zyn user is 39 and previously used another tobacco or nicotine product, according to 2023 company research conducted among customers 21 years old and older. That was the case for Will, a 30-year-old living in Brooklyn, who asked to only use his first name for privacy. Will started experimenting with tobacco products in high school and has smoked, vaped and used smokeless tobacco or dip in the past. He started regularly using Zyn about 8 months ago and says it feels cleaner and better for his health than other nicotine products he's tried. I see it as a sustainable habit, he says, until research proves me wrong, which it might. Research on the safety of nicotine pouches is ongoing, and questions remain about the effects of long-term use. But other oral products, including snus, which is similar to Zyn but contains tobacco instead of just nicotine, have been studied for decades and seem to present significantly lower risks of cancer and other diseases versus cigarettes. In 2019, the FDA allowed some snus products to be explicitly sold as lower-risk alternatives to cigarettes, marking the first time the agency has granted that permission. Based on what is currently known, Gunowitz, the nicotine researcher, says it's safe to assume nicotine pouches don't damage the lungs in the way cigarettes and e-cigarettes do, because users aren't inhaling anything. Pouches also seem to contain fewer of the cancer-causing chemicals found in traditional chewing tobacco, he says. Aside from addiction, their primary health risk for adult users likely lies in nicotine's potential to harm the cardiovascular system, which is a particular risk for people with pre-existing heart conditions, Gunowitz says. Products like these are also risky for oral health. Anytime you park a foreign substance between your teeth and gums, you are taking a risk of dental problems, such as cavities and gum disease, adds Jackler, who practiced for decades as an ear, nose and throat physician. Some researchers have raised additional concerns. One 2023 study found that oral nicotine products like Zyn contain low levels of potentially harmful substances, including ammonia and formaldehyde. And in a small 2024 study of adults who use nicotine pouches, almost all of them reported some kind of unpleasant side effect, including mouth lesions, nausea, and a sore throat or mouth. They certainly seem to be safer than tobacco cigarettes, says study co-author Ashley Dowd, a postdoctoral research fellow at Johns Hopkins University. But having a general sense that they're safe would concern me, especially, she says, if that belief prompts people who don't currently use nicotine to pick up a pouch thinking it's harmless. Dowd's study also found that most pouch users continued to smoke or vape on the side. Another 2023 study found the same thing among users ages 15 to 24 years old. Using multiple nicotine products is concerning, Jackler says, since it can deepen addiction and make continuing smoking more likely. And people, including teenagers who are new to nicotine, may become addicted more easily if they're using in multiple ways. Students may have few opportunities to smoke cigarettes during the school day, but if they can fill in those blanks by popping a nicotine pouch while sitting in class, Jagler says, they may get used to using nicotine and become dependent. The number of people who continue to smoke or vape in addition to using pouches suggests that some users can't or don't want to completely switch, perhaps because pouches don't deliver nicotine to the bloodstream rapidly enough to quell cravings, as some recent research hints. But if people want to entirely quit cigarettes or vapes in favour of pouches, as a physician I would welcome that, Jackler says. On the other hand, he adds, I wish they never got addicted to begin with. End of article. The companies driving the US green revolution, written by Shaila Raghav. The booming green technology sector has emerged as a beacon of hope, not only for investors. It's predicted to grow to $9.5 trillion by 2030, and for the many workers it employs, but also for the planet at large. Green tech companies leverage innovation and new business models to curb greenhouse gas emissions, displace unsustainable materials, and reduce the demand for non-renewable natural resources. A new statistical ranking by Time Magazine and Statista ranks 250 of America's top sustainability-focused companies based on their positive environmental impact, financial strength, and innovation to see who is rising to the top of the field. ZeroAvia, the top company in the list, develops hydrogen electric planes and already has 1,500 provisional orders for its aircraft. The most important action is to tackle the hard-to-abate sectors, such as aviation. CEO Val Mithavkov tells Time magazine, yes, we can and will tackle the low-hanging fruit, like switching to EVs or electric vehicles and building more renewables. But as that happens, we will have stubborn emissions in certain sectors that begin to make up a vast majority of the greenhouse gas impacts. Brimstone, based in Oakland, California, ranks fifth. The company produces zero-carbon cement, a groundbreaking innovation for the production of a material responsible for 5.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions. With urbanization showing no sign of slowing, experts regard reducing the climate impact of cement production as critical. Marcelo de Oliveira, Vice President of Material Science and Geology at Brimstone, tells Time magazine that the green tech boom is as much about inspiration as it is about innovation, inspiring a new generation of scientists and ecopreneurs to deploy their talent to addressing climate change. Our most valuable resource in solving this problem is people, says De Oliveira. We urgently need more individuals dedicated to addressing it. What's most striking about the ranking is the diversity of types of companies at the upper reaches of green tech, a range spurred by significant government investment via the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. The industry now reflects major investments in the panoply of approaches that will be required to reduce the environmental impact of everything from food to heavy industry and develop renewable power from solar to fusion. End of article. We have come to the end of our program. I've been reading Time magazine. My name is Angus McVicar, and this has been a production of Sight into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas, since 1967.